Self-surrender in works, the way of the Gita.
Okay.
Yes. 3 minutes meditation.
Okay. You ready?
Yep.
The Synthesis of Yoga, Chapter 3, Self-Surrender in Works, The Way of the Gita. Life, not a remote, silent, or high-uplifted ecstatic beyond. Life alone is the field of our yoga. The transformation of our superficial, narrow, and fragmentary human way of thinking, seeing, feeling, and being into a deep, and wide spiritual consciousness, and an integrated inner and outer existence, and of our ordinary human living into the divine way of life must be its central purpose. The means towards this supreme end is a self-giving of all our nature to the divine. Everything must be given to the divine within us, to the universal all, and to the transcendent supreme. An absolute concentration of our will, our heart, and our thought on that one and manifold divine. An unreserved self-consecration of our whole being to the divine alone. This is the decisive movement, the turning of the ego to that which is infinitely greater than itself, its giving, its self-giving and indispensable surrender. Read this last part again. This is the decisive movement, the turning of the ego to that which is infinitely greater than itself, its self-giving and indispensable surrender. We do one paragraph a person, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I go. The life of the human creature, as it is ordinarily lived, is composed of a half-mixed, half-fluid mass of very imperfectly ruled thoughts, perceptions, sensations, emotions, desires, enjoyments, acts, mostly customary and self-repeating, in part only dynamic and self-developing, but all centered around a superficial ego. The sum of movement of these activities eventuates in an internal growth which is partly visible and operative in this life, partly a seed of progress and lives hereafter. This growth of the conscious being, an expansion, an increasing self-expression, a more and more harmonized development of his consistent members, is the whole meaning and all the pith of human existence. It is for this meaningful development of consciousness by thought, will, emotion, desire, action and experience, leading in the end to a supreme divine self-discovery, that man, the mental being, has entered into the material body. All the rest is either auxiliary and subordinate or accidental and otios, that only matters which sustains and helps the evolution of this nature and the growth, or rather the progressive unfolding and discovery of his self and spirit.
Anybody know what otios means?
I was going to ask that too. John Robert, you usually are mine of these things. So.
I think it means hateful, but I don't have a note on it.
I think it means tamasic. Tamas. You are lazy. Laziness. Something lazy.
Let's see what Jeffrey comes up with.
Oh, I haven't looking. I'm just making notes up.
Serving no practical purpose or result. Oh. Indolent. Idle.
Indolent.
Indolent.
Okay.
So you were close, Marco.
Sorry?
You were close. Lazy is close. Yeah,
because in Italian, ozioso means lazy. So it's easy for me.
Yeah, good.
Yeah. The aim set before our yoga is nothing less than to hasten this supreme object of our existence here. Its process leaves behind the ordinary tardy method of slow and confused growth through the evolution of nature. For the natural evolution is at its best an uncertain growth under cover, partly by the pressure of the environment, partly by a groping education and an ill-lighted, purposeful effort, an only partially illumined and half-automatic use of opportunities with many blunders and lapses and relapses. A great portion of it is made up of apparent accidents and circumstances and vicissitudes, though veiling a secret divine intervention and guidance. In yoga, we replace this confused, crooked crab motion by a rapid, conscious, and self-directed evolution, which is planned to carry us as far as can be in a straight line toward the goal set before us. In a certain sense, it may be an error to speak of a goal anywhere in a progression which may well be infinite. Still, we can conceive of an immediate goal, an ulterior objective beyond our present achievement, towards which the soul in man can aspire. There lies before him the possibility of a new birth. There can be an ascent into a higher and wider plane of being, and its descent to transform his members. An enlarged and illumined consciousness is possible that shall make of him a liberated spirit and a perfected force. And if spread beyond the individual, it might even constitute a divine humanity, or else a new, a supramental, and therefore a superhuman race. It is this new birth that we make our aim. A growth into a divine consciousness is the whole meaning of our yoga, an integral conversion to divinity, not only of the soul, but of all the parts of our nature.
If I may say, just express a sort of just a statement with some, but I sometimes wonder where Sri Aurobindo takes these images, the confused crooked crab motion. And this is a perfect image. It makes it so vividly, so clear. But I never ever would be able to find for such an analogy, for such an imagery. I would love to have this, because sometimes I have this problem to express my ideas and would like to have, but please give me this CD. And it's incredible. Yeah. Okay. Just a parenthesis, footnote.
And for Andre and I, we took part in a discussion yesterday about the Vedas, which covers the same material here, but in a different way from the Vedas. So the two discussions are almost very extremely linked. Yeah. I go on. Our purpose in yoga is to exile the limited outward-looking ego and to enthrone God in its place as the ruling inhabitant of the nature. And this means first to disinherit desire and no longer accept the enjoyment of desire as the ruling human motive. The spiritual life will draw its sustenance not from desire, but from a pure and selfless delight of essential existence. Well, I'm going to read that line again. The spiritual life will draw its sustenance not from desire, but from a pure and selfless spiritual delight of essential existence. And not only the vital nature in us whose stamp is desire, but the mental being too must undergo a new birth and a transfiguring change. Our divided, egoistic, limited and ignorant thought and intelligence must disappear. In its place, there must stream in the Catholic and faultless play of a shadowless divine illumination, which shall culminate in the end in a natural, self-existent truth consciousness, free from groping half-truth and stumbling error. Truth consciousness Our confused and embarrassed, ego-centered, small-motived will and action must cease and make room for the total working of a swiftly powerful, lucidly automatic, divinely moved and guided unfallen force. There must be implanted and activized in all our doings, a supreme, impersonal, unfaltering and unstumbling will in spontaneous and untroubled unison with the will of the divine. The unsatisfying surface play of our feeble egoistic emotions must be ousted, and there must be revealed instead a secret, deep, and vast psychic heart within that waits behind them for its hour. All our feelings, impelled by this inner heart in which dwells the divine, will be transmuted into calm and intense movements of a twin passion of divine love and manifold Ananda. This is the definition of a divine humanity or a supramental race. This, not an exaggerated or even a sublimated energy of human intellect and action, is the type of the Superman whom we are called to evolve by our yoga.
In the ordinary human existence, an outgoing action is obviously 3/4 or even more of our life. It is only the exceptions, the saint and the seer, the rare thinker, poet, and artist who can live more within themselves. These indeed, at least in the most intimate parts of their nature, shape themselves more in inner thought and feeling than in the surface act. But it is not either of these sides separated from the other, but rather a harmony of the inner and the outer life made one in fullness and transfigured into a play of something beyond them, which will create the form of a perfect living. A yoga of works, a union with the divine in our will and acts, and not only in knowledge and feeling, is then an indispensable, an inexpressibly important element of an integral yoga. The conversion of our thought and feeling without a corresponding conversion of the spirit and body of our works would be a maimed achievement.
But if this total conversion is to be done, there must be a consecration of our actions and outer movements as much as of our mind and heart to the divine. There must be accepted and progressively accomplished a surrender of our capacities of working into the hands of a greater power behind us, and our sense of being the doer and worker must disappear. All must be given for more direct use into the hands of the divine will, which is hidden by these frontal appearances, for by that permitting will alone in our action possible. No, sorry, I reread the last sentence. All must be given for more direct use into the hands of the divine will, which is hidden by these frontal appearances, for by that permitting will alone is our action possible. A hidden power is a true lord and overruling observer of our acts, and only he knows through all the ignorance and perversion and deformation brought in by the ego their entire sense and ultimate purpose. There must be effected a complete transformation of our limited and distorted egoistic life and works into the larger and direct outpouring of a greater divine life, will, and energy that now secretly supports us. This greater will and energy must be made conscious in us and master. No longer must it remain as now, only a superconscious upholding and permitting force. There must be achieved an undistorted transmission through us of the all-wise purpose and process of a now hidden omniscient, omniscient power and omnipotent knowledge, which will turn into its pure, unobstructed, happily consenting and participating channel all our transmuted nature. This total consecration and surrender is this resultant entire transformation and free transmission make up the whole fundamental means and the ultimate aim of an integral karma yoga.
Even for those whose first natural movement is a consecration, a surrender and a resultant entire transformation of the thinking mind and its knowledge, or a total consecration, surrender, and transformation of the heart and its emotions, the consecration of works is a needed element in that change. Otherwise, although they may find God in other life, they will not be able to fulfill the divine in life. Life for them will be a meaningless, undivine inconsequence. Not for them the true victory that shall be the key to the riddle of our terrestrial existence. Their love will not be the absolute love triumphant over self. Their knowledge will not be the total consciousness and the all-embracing knowledge. It is possible indeed to begin with knowledge or Godward emotion solely or with both together and to leave works for the final movement of the yoga. But there is then this disadvantage that we may tend to live too exclusively within, subtilized in the subjective experience, shut off in our isolated inner parts. There we may get encrusted in our spiritual seclusion and find it difficult later on to pour ourselves triumphantly outward and apply to life our gains in the higher nature. When we turn to add this external kingdom also to our inner conquests, we shall find ourselves too much accustomed to an activity purely subjective and ineffective on the material plane. There will be an immense difficulty in transforming the outer life and the body. Or we shall find that our action does not correspond with the inner light. It still follows the old, accustomed, mistaken paths, still obeys the old, normal, imperfect influences. The truth within us continues to be separated by a painful gulf from the ignorant mechanism of our external nature. This is a frequent experience because in such a process, the light and power come to be self-contained and unwilling to express themselves in life or to use the physical means prescribed for the earth and her processes. It is as if we were living in another, a larger and subtler world and had no divine hold, perhaps little hold of any kind upon the material and terrestrial existence.
But still, each must follow his nature, and there are always difficulties that have to be accepted for some time if we are to pursue our natural path of yoga. Yoga is, after all, primarily a change of the inner consciousness and nature. And if the balance of our parts is such that this must be done first, with an initial exclusiveness and the rest left for later handling, we must accept the apparent imperfection of the process. Yet would the ideal working of an integral yoga be a movement, even from the beginning, integral in its process and whole and many-sided in its progress? In any case, our present preoccupation is with the yoga, integral in its aim and complete movement, but starting from works and proceeding by works, although at each step more and more moved by the a vivifying divine love, and more illumined by helping divine knowledge.
I have a question. Because Shevino always speaks of works, divine works. But I've sometimes, I mean, in all these years, I have formed an idea, but I'm not sure if I got it right. So what kind of works are we speaking here about? Every kind of work? What is a divine work?
Yes. I believe it's every action, every simple action. Washing your dishes, sitting down to eat, every smallest, insignificant, seemingly insignificant action can be offered up. And, you know, when we remember, and be sacrificed. We had that word sacrifice yesterday in the Vedas very centrally. And invoking the divine presence in our action so that the body is engaged in the yoga. Otherwise, we leave it behind.
Yeah,
there's not one specific work. It's whatever we do to be present for it, you know?
Yeah, so work can be equated as here, in this case, as a synonymous for every bodily action. Can we say that? Or is it a bit too superficial definition?
I think so. What do you think, John Robert?
Yeah, bodily action, but also mental action. There are ways to act with the mind, especially, you know, for a scholarly person or just for somebody who's studying or learning. So it's a totality, every kind of act. And I think Shrivan is implying here that as you get closer to the goal, these different realms begin to come together, like the poles come together in a dome at the top to one point. So down here they're pretty separated. And he's starting off with that assumption they're separated. But as they come closer and closer together, each one is infused with the other until you get to the point where it's all one.
Yeah, I'm asking this because once I'd struggled with this idea, because in our culture, especially Western, in my culture, work means job for a living. There is no other conception that goes beyond that. So the first time that I saw this, I said, okay, now I get it that it's not about that, of course.
But yeah. It is also about that. It is also.
Sure.
It includes
that.
Absolutely.
But it must not be that, necessarily.
Only.
Not only that.
Because a job, one of the things I've discovered in my own writing in science fiction, because in my science fiction saga, I evolved humans to the point that we didn't have to, we had technologies that took away the need to struggle to exist. And if you take that away, the idea of the economy falls away, because the economy is essentially there because it drives our need to survive. Jobs are all about survival.
Yep.
Work in that sense is all about survival. But of course, if you take away the need to survive, you still don't take away the desire for the divine, the interest in the divine, the interest in moving into, you know, the anxieties and emotional life and spiritual life are still present. So it gave me a different understanding. And so work, even in the sense of a job, is a whole work, even though it, in our way of talking about that kind of work, we kind of cut it away and put it in a box over there, but it's not really in a box. even when we work at a job to survive, all of our being is invested in that work, you know? So it's not different from what we're talking about here either.
Right.
Yeah. But initially I had the opposite sensation that he was talking only of that, that if you don't have a job and do it, it's a very naive understanding, but it was, I still have some problem together with this, because I have been born in a culture where you, when, if you don't have a job and if you don't work hard 8, 10, 12 hours a day and make a lot of money, and so you are sort of loser, so to speak, you are good for nothing. And subconsciously one feels this, I feel it, I mean, because I have been grown up in this sort of mindset. And sometimes I struggle with this idea of the divine works, but of course, yeah. But I intellectually I get what you mean, yes. Thank you.
And just imagine doing your job as a service to the divine. I mean, really, like when you go to work, you're, I'm going to give myself as completely as I can to do this work for the divine and by the divine, so that I don't separate it from my inner life, from my spiritual life, which is such a temptation to think, oh, now I got to do that, and then I'm cut off from the rest of my being.
But I think one should also be careful in not doing a work that does not correspond to your psychic predisposition, so to speak. If you do a work that is not resonant with your inner being, then I think tension builds up. There. Yeah. Okay. It's a long.
If you have the luxury of choice.
Yeah.
If you have the luxury of choice, everybody.
Yeah, okay.
Like Aurobindo says, we're all where we are in the process of moving towards the divine, but we're all where we are even in choosing things like a job, you know. So somebody may, for whatever reason, be pulled into work that doesn't really represent their inner being, but that's where they are in their life, and they'll eventually move beyond that realization to something else, right? I don't think, I mean, if it's about you and your own life choices, that's a good reflection, but it's not a thing about thinking about other people and the choices they make.
Yeah, sure. That's good. Thank you.
So I forgot who reads next.
You do, I think.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, we go on. The greatest gospel of spiritual works ever yet given to the race, the most perfect system of karma yoga known to man in the past, is to be found in the Bhagavad Gita. In that famous episode of the Mahabharata, the great basic lines of karma yoga are laid down for all time with an incomparable mastery and the infallible eye of an assured experience. It is true that the path alone, as the ancients saw it, is worked out fully. The perfect fulfillment, the highest secret, is hinted rather than developed. It is kept back as an unexpressed part of a supreme mystery. There are obvious reasons for this reticence. For the fulfillment is in any case a matter of experience, and no teaching can express it. It cannot be described in a way that can really be understood by a mind that has not the effulgent transmuting experience. And for the soul that has passed this shining portals and stands in the blaze of the inner light, All mental and verbal description is as poor as it is superfluous, inadequate, and an impertinence. All divine consummations have perforce to be figured by us in the inept and deceptive terms of a language which was made to fit the normal experience of mental men. So expressed, they can be rightly understood only by those who already know, and knowing are able to give these poor external terms a changed inner and transfigured sense. As the Vedic rishis insisted in the beginning, the words of the Supreme Wisdom are expressive only to those who are already of the wise. The Gita, at its cryptic close, may seem by its silence to stop short of that solution for which we are seeking. It pauses at the borders of the highest spiritual mind and does not cross them into the splendors of the supramental light. And yet its secret of dynamic and not only static identity with the inner presence, its highest mystery of absolute surrender to the divine guide, Lord and inhabitant of our nature, is the central secret. This surrender is the indispensable means of the supramental change. And again, it is through the supramental change that the dynamic identity becomes possible.
What then are the lines of Karma Yoga laid down by the Gita? Its key principle, its spiritual method, can be summed up as the union of two largest and highest states or powers of consciousness, equality and oneness. The kernel of its method is an unreserved acceptance of the divine in our life as in our inner self and spirit. An inner renunciation of personal desire leads to equality, accomplishes our total surrender to the divine, supports delivery from dividing ego, which brings us oneness. An inner renunciation of personal desire leads to equality, accomplishes our total surrender to the divine, supports a delivery from dividing ego, which brings us oneness. But this must be a oneness in dynamic force and not only in static peace or inactive beatitude. The Gita promises us freedom for the spirit even in the midst of works and the full energies of nature, if we accept subjection of our whole being to that which is higher than the separating and limiting ego. It proposes an integral dynamic activity founded on a still passivity, a largest possible action irrevocably based on an immobile calm, is its secret, free expression out of a supreme inward silence.
All things here are the one and indivisible, eternal, transcendent, and cosmic Brahman, that is in its seeming divided, in things. All things here are the one and indivisible, eternal, transcendent, and cosmic Brahman that is in its seeming divided in things and creatures. In seeming only, for in truth, it is always one and equal in all things and creatures, and the division is only a phenomenon of the surface. As long as we live in the ignorant seeming, we are the ego and are subject to the modes of nature. Enslaved to appearances, bound to dualities, tossed between good and evil, sin and virtue, grief and joy, pain and pleasure, good fortune and ill fortune, success and failure. We follow helplessly the iron or gilt and iron round of the wheel of Maya. At best, we have only the poor relative freedom, which by us is ignorantly called free will. But that is at bottom illusory, since it is the modes of nature that express themselves through our personal will. It is a force of nature grasping us, ungrasped by us, that determines what we shall will and how we shall will it. Nature, not an independent ego, chooses what objects we shall seek, whether by reasoned will or unreflecting impulse at any moment of our existence. If, on the contrary, we live in the unifying reality of the Brahman, then we go beyond the ego and overstep nature. For then we get back to our true self and become the spirit. In the spirit, we are above the impulsion of nature, superior to her modes and forces. Attaining to a perfect equality in the soul, mind, and heart, we realize our true self of oneness, one with all beings, one too with that which expresses itself in them and in all that we see and experience. This equality and this oneness are the indispensable twin foundation that we must lay down for a divine being, a divine consciousness, a divine action. Not one with all, we are not spiritual, not divine. Not equaled souled, not equaled souled to all things, happenings, and creatures, we cannot see spiritually, cannot know divinely, cannot feel divinely towards others. The supreme power, the one eternal and infinite, is equal to all things and to all beings. And because it is equal, it can act with an absolute wisdom according to the truth of its works and its force, and according to the truth of each thing and of each creature.
This is also the only true freedom possible to man, a freedom which he cannot have unless he outgrows his mental separativeness and becomes the conscious soul in nature. The only free will in the world is the one divine will of which nature is the executrix, for she is the master and creator of all other wills. Human free will can be real in a sense, but like all things that belong to the modes of nature, it is only relatively real. The mind rides on a swirl of natural forces, balances on a poise between several possibilities, inclines to one side or another, settles, and has the sense of choosing. But it does not see, it is not even dimly aware of the force behind that has determined its choice. It cannot see it because that force is something total, and to our eyes, indeterminate. At most, mind can only distinguish with an approach to clarity and precision some out of the complex variety of particular determinations by which this force works out her incalculable purposes. Partial itself, the mind rides on a part of the machine, unaware of 9/10 of its motor agencies in time and environment, unaware of its past preparation and future drift. But because it rides, it thinks that it is directing the machine. In a sense, it counts, for that clear inclination of the mind that we call our will, that firm settling of the inclination which presents itself to us as a deliberate choice, is one of nature's most powerful determinants, but it is never independent and sole. Behind this petty instrumental action of the human will, there is something vast and powerful and eternal that oversees the trend of the inclination and presses on the turn of the will. There is a total truth in nature greater than our individual choice. And in this total truth, or even beyond and behind it, there is something that determines all results. Its presence and secret knowledge keep us steadily in the process of nature, a dynamic, almost automatic perception of the right relations, the varying or persistent necessities, the inevitable steps of the movement. There is a secret divine will, eternal and infinite, omniscient and omnipotent, that expresses itself in the universality and in each particular of all these apparently temporal and finite, inconscient or half-conscient things. This is the power or presence meant by the Gita when it speaks of the Lord within the heart of all existences, who turns all creatures as if mounted on a machine by the illusion of nature.
This divine will is not an alien power or presence. It is intimate to us, and we ourselves are part of it. For it is our own highest self that possesses and supports it. Only it is not our conscious mental will. It rejects often enough what our conscious will accepts, and accepts what our conscious will rejects. For while this secret one knows all and every whole and every and each detail, our surface mind knows only a little part of things. Our will is conscious in the mind, and what it knows by the thought only. The divine will is superconscious to us because it is in its essence supramental, and it knows all because it is all. Our highest self, which possesses and supports this universal power, is not our ego self, not our personal nature. It is something transcendent and universal, of which these smaller things are only foam and flowing surface. If we surrender our conscious will and allow it to be made one with the will of the eternal, then and then only shall we attain to a true freedom. Living in the divine liberty, we shall no longer cling to this shackled, so-called free will, a puppet freedom, ignorant, illusory, relative, bound to the error of its own inadequate vital motives and mental figures. So there.
This is very interesting. This is also a very interesting coincidence. All the day today, I was searching for the actual scientific knowledge about the so-called free will, because there are also experiments in neuroscience which try to establish if we have free will or not, and these are experiments that have been contested many times. Then they make a counter experiment. The initiator of these experiments was an American psychologist whose name was Libet, James Libet, I don't remember, Libet, and he made some experiments, but the results are until nowadays very controversial. And I think that if they would read this chapter here, a lot of misunderstandings would be clarified immediately. Because we have still this understanding of free will. Because the question is, who is supposed to be free from what? This is a question that, as far as I could see, the philosophers and scientists making these experiments and tackling with the problem of free will generally do not consider, but it is central. Because in a certain sense, here Sri Aurobindo says we have no free will, and yet we can attain free will. Whereas modern science asks, do we have or don't we have free will? It is yes-no question that leaves not much space in between. As I understand, Sri Aurobindo says there are different grades. The more we become conscious and unite with the divine, the more we will attain this free will. But in our actual human, half-animal consciousness, we are not, where there is very few free will. And it's interesting because it's a sort of synchronicity. I don't know if you have heard about these experiments, but this part should be read by these people. Maybe could clarify them, their ideas. Okay.
You're pondering there brings me back to this line in the middle of, for me, it's page 89, but it does not see, it is not even dimly aware of the force behind that has determined its choice. It cannot see because that force is something total and to our eyes indeterminate.
Exactly.
It's like you're like a fish in the water, it doesn't know what water is.
Yes, exactly. A good
because
image.
Because that's all there is.
Perfect image, yes.
Yeah.
But according one of the part of these philosophers of so-called physicalists say that we are just a bunch of particles and biochemical reactions. There is at bottom this free will is only an illusion. In reality, in principle, if you would have a supercomputer that can calculate the dynamics of every particle, atom, molecule, it could determine your actions and so therefore show that you don't have any free will. You're just a biological machine. And the question is, yeah, but how can you disprove that? It's not that easy. It's philosophical, scientific question that is very tricky. I believe that what he says, and I feel that this is a deep truth in that. But how can you prove that? Scientifically, I think you cannot. You can only have the experience of that. And that's a problem that you have with when you speak with these scientists. They see only one part. They see the nature. They don't see the soul. They say that there is only prakriti, no? The nature. There is no purusha. That is just an illusion of your brain. So, well, okay, this was...
That reminds me of where Sri Aurobindo talks in what we just read about, that you cannot speak of it to those who don't know it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a pity, but it's true. Sad, but true.
Seems to me that a lot of artists and people in the art world, writers, poets, have experiences of this when they acknowledge that inspiration comes. And I've focused in on this because it's interesting to me. I've heard a lot of writers or other artists talk about this, and they don't say much about where it comes from, but it's pretty clear that it's coming from somewhere else, because if they were writing a novel, all of a sudden the characters started saying, no, that's not what I'm doing, I'm doing this other thing, and the writer starts kind of being dictated to by the characters in the novel. And it's also true in a sculptor that lives on the West Coast here who has that experience in her sculpture. That it's that there's some other place from which the inspiration to do the right thing, the thing that's perfect for what this artist is trying to do, and the artist becomes more of a scribe or a secretary or something than the one who gets, who should get, you know, the copyright and all of that kind of thing for the piece.
So I love this piece, partial itself, the mind rides on a part of the machine, unaware of 9/10 of its motor agencies in time and environment, unaware of its past preparation and future drift, but because it rides, it thinks that it is directing the machine. You know, this is actually very close to modern cognitive understanding of what's going on, right? So.
Yeah, they get it right, and nevertheless they get it wrong, because if you have this integral vision, you see that they are, it's true, but yet there is something wrong in this idea, no? Nevertheless, okay, should I go on? It's my turn, or I've lost track. I think the last to read was Andrea.
Yes, it's your turn. And I just got a message from Matteo saying he sent you a message, Marco, but apparently you didn't get it.
Yeah, because I don't have my phone here. Should I look?
No, he said that he wasn't going to be able to make it. So.
Okay. Yeah, because when I have these sessions, I shut down my phone because it makes it, every time that they call me, the phone makes it through nevertheless, if I don't shut it down completely. So I don't hear it. Okay. A distinction has to be firmly seized in our consciousness. The capital distinction between mechanical nature and the free lord of nature. Between the Ishvara, or single luminous divine will, and the many executive modes and forces of the universe. Nature, not as she is in her divine truths, the conscious power of the eternal, but as she appears to us in the ignorance, is executive force and mechanical in her steps. Not consciously intelligent to our experience of her, although all her works are instinct with an absolute intelligence. Not in herself master, she is full of a self-aware power. This power is the conscious divine Shakti of the Ishvara, the transcendent and universal mother, which has an infinite mastery, and because of this power driving her, she rules all and exactly fulfills the work intended in her by the Ishvara. No, not enjoying, but enjoyed, she bears in herself the burden of all enjoyments. Nature as Prakriti is an inertly active force, for she works out a movement imposed upon her. But within her is one that knows. Some entity sits there that is aware of all her motion and process. Prakriti works containing the knowledge, the mastery, the delight of the Purusha, the being associated with her or seated within her. But she can participate in them only by subjection and reflection of that which fills her. Purusha knows and is still and inactive. He contains the action of Prakriti within his consciousness and knowledge, and enjoys it. He gives the sanction to Prakriti's works, and she works out what is sanctioned by him for his pleasure. Purusha himself does not execute. He maintains Prakriti in her action and allows her to express in energy and process and formed result what he perceives in his knowledge. This is a distinction made by the Sankhyas, and although it is not all the true truths, not in any way the highest truths either, of Purusha or Prakriti, still it is a valid and indispensable practical knowledge in the lower hemisphere of existence.
So I'm kind of lost in this passage. I don't know if I'm the only one, but...
It's complicated.
Yeah. It just seems full of contradictions. I mean, there's a general line, but yeah.
Well, he's talking about the lower and higher views of Purusha and Prakriti, of nature and soul. And see, so he's saying that from the higher sense, which he's been talking about, what that we could see if we had achieved the freedom that he was talking about in the previous paragraph. In the higher sense, the nature or Prakriti is the Supreme Mother. She's filled with the Supreme Mother, he says. In other words, it's the active creative force of the One that is in operation in everything. But where we sit, the lower realm, nature is still filled and driven by the Divine Mother. But nature in this lower realm doesn't experience it as its own freedom. It experiences it as something that's automatic. And that's how we experience it, being part of nature ourselves, obviously. We experience it as automatic. And I think it's really interesting where he talks about, so the soul, the Purusha and nature, Prakriti. Purusha, knows and enjoys the activities of Prakriti. So in the essays on the Gita, Sri Aurobindo talks about the form has the knower inside of it, and the form and the knower inside of it follows the law of the form. So in our level, the knower inside of nature, inside of every part of nature, is still the knower. And at the same time, he's following the law of that nature, the law of human nature, the law of cat nature, the law of mountain nature, the law of rock nature, and all, the law of water nature, and so on. And he enjoys it. So that's the bliss that is at the basis of everything, the enjoyment of the divine in the whole manifestation, whether we can see it from a higher point of view, see the enjoyment, or from a lower point of view where it's just really impenetrable and confusing to us. I don't know if that helps, but that's what he's talking about. And he's talking about the Sankhyas here at the bottom. The Sankhyas was a spiritual philosophical tradition in India that Sri Aurobindo draws on, and he gets these terms, Purusha and Prakriti, from the Sankhya tradition. And he uses them more or less like the Sankhya tradition used them. I keep thinking.
Sorry. Does help. That does help, John.
Okay. I keep thinking about this phrase here, and enjoys it. It's at the bottom of the, well, it's at the bottom of the, it's about 10 or 12 lines from the end of the paragraph. He enjoys it. And so I'm thinking of the world today. So the Purusha enjoys the attack on the capital, the global warming, and all of this drama that we have in the outer world is, since there's only one, really, there's only one being, according to Indian spiritual philosophy, it's all the action of the One in the many. And it seems like that's, getting a sense of that, the enjoyment of what we call destruction or horror or, you know, all the rest of those things, is a real key to equality.
Yes, indeed, I think so, yeah. From the, he also, Shobindu describes in several parts, and from the highest point of view, everything is perfectly okay. I always struggle with this, but yeah. But another thing here, where he says, Purusha knows and is still and inactive. I just wonder, because I read somewhere else where he says that Purusha can also be active. But he says still. Why still and inactive? Why and? I don't understand why that and is a conjunction. But
Marco?
Means, yeah.
Marco, he is still. He doesn't move.
Still? And, ah, okay. Ah,
and yeah. Inactive. It's
okay,
language.
Thank you. Yeah. is still and inactive. Okay, I will keep this in mind for the rest of the reading of all the book of Synthesis of Yoga, because I'm pretty sure that I saw him saying that somewhere else, that Purusha can be quite active also. But
yeah, he says that as the soul knowledge develops in us, as the Purusha knowledge develops in us, so that we're not just purely the automaton of nature, that the soul sanctions. So it's not just witnessing,
yeah,
but it sanctions.
Sanctions.
And so there it becomes active. And and actually enjoyment is an activity. And I think it's a lot of it is just a way of talking. Our minds understand duality. We don't really understand unity. So he's separating these two out in a way that makes it understandable for the mind, the Purusha and the Prakriti.
In fact, at the end, he says also, and also it is not all the truths. Not in any way the highest truth either, of Purusha or of Prakriti. Still, it is a valid and indispensable practical knowledge. Yeah, at the end he says this. Yeah. So it's a redux, so to speak. Wait for the version 2.0. Yeah.
I think it's my turn to read, is that right? The individual soul or the conscious being in a form may identify itself with this experiencing Purusha or with this active Prakriti. If it identifies itself with Prakriti, it is not master, enjoyer, and knower, but reflects the modes and workings of Prakriti. It enters by its identification into that subjection and mechanical working, which is characteristic of her. And even by an entire immersion in Prakriti, the soul becomes inconscient or subconscient, asleep in her forms as in the earth and the metal, or almost asleep as in plant life. There, in that inconscience, it is subject to the domination of tamas, the principle, the power, the qualitative mode of obscurity and inertia. Sattva and rajas are there, but they are concealed in the thick coating of tamas. Emerging into its own proper nature of consciousness, but not yet truly conscious, because there is still too great a domination of tamas in the nature, the embodied being becomes more and more subject to rajas, the principle, the power, the qualitative mode of action and passion, impelled by desire and instinct. There is then formed and developed the animal nature, narrow in consciousness, rudimentary in intelligence, rajaso-tamasic in vital habit and impulse. Emerging yet farther from the great in conscience toward a spiritual status, the embodied being liberates sattva, the mode of light, and acquires a relative freedom and mastery and knowledge, and with it, a qualified and conditioned sense of inner satisfaction and happiness. Man, the mental being in a physical body, should be, but is not, except in a few among this multitude of ensouled bodies of this nature. Ordinarily, he has too much in him of the obscure earth inertia and a troubled, ignorant animal life force to be a soul of light and bliss, or even a mind of harmonious will and knowledge. There is here in man an incomplete and still hampered and baffled ascension toward the true character of the Purusha, free, master, knower, and enjoyer. For these are in human and earthly experience relative modes, none giving its single and absolute fruit. All are intermixed with each other, and there is not the pure action of any one of them anywhere. It is their confused and inconstant interaction that determines the experiences of the egoistic human consciousness swinging in nature's uncertain balance.
Wow, how brilliant. Love that passage. The sign of the immersion of the embodied soul in Prakriti is the limitation of consciousness to the ego. The vivid stamp of this limited consciousness can be seen in a constant inequality of the mind and heart, and a confused conflict and disharmony in their varied reactions to the touches of experience. The human reactions sway perpetually between the dualities created by the soul's subjection to nature, by its often intense but narrow struggle for mastery and enjoyment. A struggle for the most part ineffective. The soul circles in an unending round of nature's alluring and distressing opposites, success and failure, good fortune and ill fortune, good and evil, sin and virtue, joy and grief, pain and pleasure. It is only when, awaking from its immersion in Prakriti, it perceives its oneness with the One, and its oneness with all existences, that it can become free from these things and found its right relation to this executive world nature. Then it becomes indifferent to her inferior modes, equally minded to her dualities, capable of mastery and freedom. It is seated above her as the high-throned knower and witness, filled with the calm, intense, unalloyed delight of his own eternal existence. The embodied spirit continues to express its powers in action, but it is no longer involved in ignorance, no longer bound by its works. Its actions have no longer a consequence within it, but only a consequence outside in Prakriti. The whole movement of nature becomes, to its experience, a rising and falling of waves. On the surface, that make no difference to its own unfathomable peace, its wide delight, its vast universal equality, or its boundless God existence. It is not indispensable for the karma yoga to accept implicitly all the philosophy of the Gita. We may regard it, if we like, as a statement of psychological experience useful as a practical basis for the yoga. Here it is a perfectly valid and in entire consonance with a high and wide experience. For this reason, I have thought it well to state it here, as far as possible in the language of modern thought, omitting all that belongs to metaphysics rather than psychology. You're muted, Andrea.
So it is 1:20. Shall we do another section? Pretty short. I'll read the next three paragraphs since they're a little. These are the conditions of our effort, and they point to an ideal which can be expressed in these or in equivalent formulae. To live in God and not in the ego, to move vastly founded, not in the little egoistic consciousness, but in the consciousness of the all soul and the transcendent, to be perfectly equal in all happenings and to all beings, and to see and feel them as one with oneself and one with the divine. To feel all in oneself and all in God. To feel God in all and oneself in all. To act in God and not in the ego. And here first, not to choose action by reference to personal needs and standards, but in obedience to the dictates of the living highest truth above us. Next, as soon as we are sufficiently founded in the spiritual consciousness, not to act any longer by our separate will or movement, but more and more to allow action to happen and develop under the impulsion and guidance of a divine will that surpasses us. And last, the supreme result to be exalted into an identity in knowledge, force, consciousness, act, joy of existence with the divine Shakti, to feel a dynamic movement not dominated by mortal desire and vital instinct and impulse and elusive mental free will, but luminously conceived and evolved in an immortal self-delight and an infinite self-knowledge. For this is the action that comes by a conscious subjection and merging of the natural man into the divine self and eternal spirit. It is the spirit that forever transcends and guides this world nature.
I would say we could stop here. A bit early, but then we have a lot, another section which goes on.
I'm just noticing we're almost at the end of the chapter.
Yeah, it's still 1, 2, 3, and 1/3 pages. Yeah. So should we stretch, or should we close a little bit earlier, or should we close earlier and make the next time read it through again, eventually? I don't know. Leave it to you.
I think we might read, push through and read to the end. What do you think?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But by what practical steps of self-discipline can we arrive at this consummation? The elimination of egoistic activity and of its foundation, the egoistic consciousness, consciousness is clearly the key to the consummation we desire. And since in the path of works, action is a knot we have first to loosen. We must endeavor to loosen it where it is centrally tied, in desire and in ego. For otherwise we shall cut only stray strands and not the heart of our bondage. These are the two knots of our subjection to this ignorant and divided nature, desire and ego sense. And of these two desires has its native home in the emotions and sensations and instincts, and from there affects thought and volition. Ego sense lives indeed in these movements, but it casts its deep roots also in the thinking mind and its will, and it is there that it becomes fully self-conscious. These are the twin obscure powers of the obsessing worldwide ignorance that we have to enlighten and eliminate. I may read another paragraph, but quite short. So, in the field of action, desire takes many forms, but the most powerful of all is a vital self's craving or seeking after the fruit of our works. The fruit we covet may be reward of internal pleasure. It may be the accomplishment of some preferred idea or some cherished will, or the satisfaction of the egoistic emotions, or else the pride of success of our highest hopes and ambitions. Or it may be an external reward, a recompense entirely material, wealth, position, honor, victory, good fortune, or any other fulfillment of vital or physical desire. But all alike are lures by which egoism holds on. Always these satisfactions delude us with the sense of mastery and the idea of freedom, while really we are harnessed and guided, or ridden and whipped by some gross or subtle, some noble or ignoble figure of the blind desire that derives the world. Therefore, the first rule of action laid down by the Gita is to do the work that should be done without any desire for the fruit, nishkama karma.
A simple rule in appearance, and yet how difficult to carry out with anything like an absolute sincerity and liberating entireness. In the greater part of our action, we use the principle very little, if at all. And then even mostly as a sort of counterpoise to the normal principle of desire, and to mitigate the extreme action of that tyrant impulse. At best, we are satisfied if we arrive at a modified and disciplined egoism, not too shocking to our moral sense, and not too brutally offensive to others. And to our partial self-discipline, we give various names and forms. We habituate ourselves by practice to the sense of duty, to a firm fidelity to principle, a stoic fortitude, or a religious resignation, a quiet or an ecstatic submission to God's will. But it is not these things that the Gita intends, useful though they are in their place. It aims at something absolute, unmitigated, uncompromising, a turn, an attitude that will change the whole poise of the soul. Not the mind's control of vital impulse is its rule, but the strong immobility of an immortal spirit.
The test it lays down is an absolute equality of the mind and the heart to all results, to all reactions, to all happenings. If good fortune and evil fortune, if respect and insult, if reputation and obloquy, if victory and defeat, if pleasant event and sorrowful event leave us not only unshaken, but untouched, free in the emotions, free in the nervous reactions, free in the mental view, not responding with the least disturbance or vibration in any spot of the nature, then we have the absolute liberation to which the Gita points us, but not otherwise. The tiniest reaction is a proof that the discipline is imperfect, and that some part of us accepts ignorance and bondage as its law and clings to the old nature. Our self-conquest is only partially accomplished. It is still imperfect or unreal in some stretch or part or smallest spot of the ground of our nature. That little pebble of imperfection may throw down the whole achievement of the yoga.
There are certain semblances of an equal spirit which must not be mistaken for the profound and vast spiritual equality which the Gita teaches. There is an equality of disappointed resignation, an equality of pride, an equality of hardness and indifference. All these are egoistic in their nature. Inevitably, they come in the course of the sadhana, but they must be rejected or transformed into the true quietude. There is too, on a higher level, the equality of the stoic, the equality of a devout resignation or a sage detachment, the equality of a soul aloof from the world and indifferent to its doings. These two are insufficient. First approaches they can be, but they are at most early soul phases only, or imperfect mental preparations for our entry into the true and absolute self-existent, wide, equal oneness of the spirit.
I have evenness of the spirit. Is it
yes,
only me?
I too. Yeah.
You have equal oneness, Andrea?
I have an earlier version and mine says equal oneness.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So probably white evenness is in the new version. For it is certain that so great a result cannot be arrived at immediately and without any previous stages. At first, we have to learn to bear the shocks of the world with the central part of our being untouched and silent. Even when the surface mind, heart, life are strongly shaken, unmoved there on the bedrock of our life, we must separate the soul watching behind or immune deep within from these outer workings of our nature. Afterwards, extending this calm and steadfastness of the detached soul to its instruments, it will become slowly possible to eradicate peace from the luminous center.
To radiate peace.
Sorry. Yes. Yeah. Okay, I read it again. Afterwards, extending this calm and steadfastness of the detached soul to its instruments, it will become slowly possible to radiate peace from the luminous center to the darker peripheries. In this process, we may take the passing help of many minor phases, a certain stoicism, a certain calm philosophy, a certain religious exaltation may help us towards some nearness to our aim, or we may call in even less strong and exalted but still useful powers of our mental nature. In the end, we must either discard or transform them and arrive instead at an entire equality, a perfect self-existent peace within, and even, if we can, a total, unassailable, self-poised and spontaneous delight in all our members.
But how then shall we continue to act it at all? For ordinarily, the human being acts because he has a desire or feels a mental, vital, or physical want or need. He is driven by the necessities of the body, by the lust of riches, honors, or fame, or by a craving for the personal satisfactions of the mind or the heart, or a craving for power or pleasure. Or he is seized and pushed about by a moral need, or at least the need or the desire of making his ideas or his ideals or his will or his party or his country or his gods prevail in the world. If none of these desires, nor any other, must be the spring of our action, it would seem as if all incentive or motive power had been removed, and action itself must necessarily cease. The Gita replies with its third great secret of the divine life. All action must be done in a more and more Godward, and finally a God-possessed consciousness. Our works must be a sacrifice to the divine, and in the end, a surrender of all our being, mind, will, heart, sense, life, and body to the one must make God love and God service our only motive. This transformation of the motive force and very character of works is indeed its master idea. It is the foundation of its unique synthesis of works, love, and knowledge. In the end, not desire, but the consciously felt will of the eternal remains as the sole driver of our action and the sole originator of its initiative. Equality, renunciation of all desire for the fruit of our works, action done as a sacrifice to the Supreme Lord of our nature and of all natures. These are the three first Godward approaches in the Gita's way of Karma Yoga. End of the chapter.
We were wondering where the practical aspect is here in this book. I think with this chapter we have tons and tons of practical aspects to exercise with for the next, not only 2 weeks, perhaps two lifetimes eventually.
Well, it seems that the whole chapter actually is directing us to transmute our actions, right? Yeah. How we are in the world, everything. So it's very practical, actually.
Yeah.
But how to is another question.
So any thoughts on the relationship between detachment that he describes here and Buddhist practice detachment?
Buddhist practice is very much focused on impermanence and on the that nothing is real. It's very different from what Sherbindo is talking about. Mm. Sherbindo is really talking about being in life, in the world, and active in the world, and the being detached from the ego. Whereas in Buddhism, as I understand it, they want to be detached from what they call reality or the illusion of reality. Sri Aurobindo has no business with that. And I'm very happy about that. I don't know whether I'm correct in this, but that's kind of my, off the top of my head. Does it make any sense?
Yeah.
I'm not entirely, I mean, I get what you're coming from, but I find it very judgmental towards Buddhism. A little bit sounds a bit judgmental. And I think there's more going on in Buddhism than that is my feeling.
Of
course. But I can't speak to it with any knowledge, right? So.
Yeah, I don't know much about Buddhism either, but as I understand it, there are point of connections, there are similarities, not only differences, because this detachment, where he in this chapter, I don't know if it escaped to my attention, but frequently he speaks also of taking this witness attitude. Becoming detachment as becoming the witness without thinking about just a witness of everything that happens. And that's in some sense how I understand also the detachment in Buddhism. I don't think that it is so different. Yeah? The philosophical background, the cosmology, so to speak, is very different. And I think also this idea of Buddhism that detaches from life is no longer true in the modern form of Buddhism. Nowadays, when I hear Buddhists speaking, I don't have the sensation that we must keep in mind that this was written 100 years ago. And Buddhism at those times might have favored this ascetic aspect of spirituality, especially perhaps in the environment where Sri Aurobindo lived. But I think this modern Buddhism does not favor this. They have not this conception of the supramental. They have not an evolutionary component. That's what is missing for me in Buddhism. This idea of evolution, spiritual evolution, or it's at least it's not so emphasized. But this equality, it is equality of a Buddha. That's how I understand it. When Sri Aurobindo speaks about equality, renunciation of all desire, this is very Buddhistic, I think, in a certain sense. But, okay, I'm not a scholar of Buddhism, so it's just my intuitive understanding how I have seen it elsewhere.
The Buddhists that I know, the people who I know who practice Buddhism are, extremely aware of the daily reality of the world and the need to invest in it. I don't see this sort of detachment as being a detachment from reality, but the same kind of detachment from, overinvestment in the ego. It seems to me that a lot of the detachment that you see in Buddhism has some, is it, I see the echoes and resonances more than I see any fundamental difference. Although I guess my question was, there are some differences going on here. So.
Yeah. I do feel that a lot of their teaching is very practical and very, very applicable to the integral yoga, totally. You were asking about difference, so that's where I went.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I rarely saw Sri Aurobindo criticizing Buddhism. He criticizes asceticism. That's what he usually criticizes. But Buddhism, and not only mother made. I don't know if it was a writing or a compilation of her talks, but there is her commentary on the Dhammapada, and perhaps there we can find more connection between Buddhism and integral yoga. There certainly she will have, I didn't read that. I don't know if you read that, but there probably she will have outlined the differences and commonalities between integral yoga and Buddhism. Dhammapada, comments on the Dhammapada of Mother.
Yeah. I think there she's more commenting on the practical benefits of that approach rather than the kind of the deep differences. Mm.
But she embraces it. She sees it as a valuable teaching, Buddhist teaching.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, was it Mother? I think it was Mother that said that the Buddha came to her. And one of them, I think Sri Aurobindo said that, or it was a mother, said that integral yoga in its perfection, in its perfect state, embraces all ways, all paths. Yeah. It completes them, maybe. I mean, not so much exactly as they are in our human version, but again, kind of getting back to the basic oneness of Indian spiritual philosophy. Yeah, I've wondered about this myself, because actually Sri Aurobindo does talk about Buddhism in the life divine, and he says that that Buddhism's goal is nirvana. It's not the transformation of the world, it's nirvana.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that does seem to be the traditional teaching of Buddhism, yet when I read something by the Dalai Lama or some of the other Buddhist teachers today, I don't really hear that emphasized very much. So I don't know whether Buddhism has changed. I mean, maybe everything has changed because of the supramental manifestation. I really don't know. But I've wondered about it because Sri Aurobindo, he doesn't criticize it very much, but he does say specifically, this is what Buddhism is after, and this is not what, we're not after that.
But
again, I don't know if it's changed or not since.
But
then.
Isn't Buddhism really? I mean, you say the goal is nirvana, but I think, if I understand it rightly, the goal is to free humanity from suffering. Nirvana is the solution proposed, but the goal is to free human beings from suffering. And that is very close to this goal of Aurobindo. It's just that the method chosen or proposed by Aurobindo is different from the one proposed by Buddha. But the goal is similar, I think.
Well, I think that Sri Aurobindo, when he talks about it in The Life Divine, he's talking about about liberation. Buddhism as a path of liberation, not of transformation. Liberation is different from transformation.
Yeah.
But again, I haven't studied Buddhist philosophy. I've taken some Buddhist courses, and some of it's really wonderful. But if it's specifically a path of liberation, like some of the other Indian spiritual paths, yogic paths are, Sherman makes a clear distinction between that and the transformation of not only of human beings, but of life and matter. It's a transformation rather than the liberation from it. He says that liberation is the first step of that,
exactly.
But it's not the completion of it.
Exactly, yes. There can be no complete transformation without liberation. So nirvana is also not the aim, but an intermediate step in the whole transformation of the whole being. But also Aurobindo describes very well his experience of nirvana. So there is this famous letter or account where he says that he was in this nirvana and all the world appeared as an illusion and so on. But it is part of the integral yoga. But he also says that our yoga begins there where other yogas end, which means it integralizes, it goes, extends, and goes beyond that, but it does not exclude them. Quite the contrary, I think without nirvana, you will get only to a certain point, and then you will be stuck there.
There are a couple of wonderful cantos in Savitri on nirvana, on the experience of nirvana.
Yeah.
Especially one by the character in Savitri for whom the epic is named, of her experience of nirvana. And it's an integral part of her yoga.
Yeah.
But it's not the end of it.
Yeah.
Great.
Shall we?
So we need a meditation.
Yep. Ready.
I always find the meditation so short. 3 minutes seems to just whip by, but
I'll make it 4 minutes. How's that?
Yeah. Good.
Sorry. There we go.
Thank you.
That was 4 minutes. It still felt like nothing.
It's. And thank you for asking for more.
Seems to be this thing in the integral yoga community that we'll have a minute of meditation before we do something instead of 10 or 15 or 30. I don't know why that is.
All right, my dears. Thank you for a lovely time.
Very fruitful.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Really enjoy it. Bye.